eyes. He took all the students out behind Macon High to a creek and had them reenact parts of the book, forcing them to choose sides and role-play. When they read a classic such as Macbeth, he asked them to read it again if he felt they didn't understand it the first time. When they did, the students were surprised to find that they enjoyed it more the second time. As Sweet explained, "The more you give to a great piece of literature, the more it gives back." Most of the students had never experienced a teacher like Sweet. Some had grown up on farms that lacked hot water. Others had gone the first 15 years of their lives without reading anything much longer than a comic book. Yet as a freshman named David Wells later put it, "With Sweet, I was learning without even realizing it." In Schartzer's case, it was in spite of his best efforts. Steve was one of those boys who'd avoided books the best he could, preferring to spend his time playing sports. He was bright enough, but had often put that intellect to use, finding ways to avoid doing work, whether it was charming a teacher or enlisting his older sister Pat's help on a book report. Yet even Schartzer didn't mind Sweet's class. By the end of the semester, the strange-looking man in the corduroy jacket had become his favorite teacher. He was by no means alone. Had you polled the Macon High population, there's a good chance a majority of the students would have agreed. The local parents, however, were not as enamored. Not only did they find Sweet's curriculum unusual and the lack of grammar troubling, but he kept sending their kids home with strange, seemingly dangerous books. Not just Brave New World and Heart of Darkness, but Lord Jim, and worst of all, that play, Inherit the Wind, which struck many in the deeply religious town as blasphemous. Had Sweet's teaching methods been the extent of his transgressions, the parents might have let it slide. They were not. The whispers had started within weeks of Sweet's arrival in Macon in January of 1966. They began in the halls of the high school and spread through the town like so much pollen drifting in the wind, from the taverns to the Methodist church off Route 51 to the fake wood tabletops in dozens of kitchens. "Did you hear about that new teacher? Did you hear what he has those kids reading? Did you see that new Mustang he's driving? Did you know he's not going to church? Any church? Did you see that girl he had with him last week, the one from Champaign?" Even if Sweet had wanted to stay under the radar in Macon, it would have been impossible. New hires at the high school were announced on the front page of the Macon News, accompanied by a home address. If he forgot to pay his taxes, it was a matter of public record. His name included in the News' annual delinquent personal property tax list, which listed all sums, ranging from the paltry $1.93 for one Miss Elsie Damery in 1965, to the truly scandalous, a town-high $171.95 for Mr. J.T. Hogan. Other information could be ferreted out without much trouble. With limited telephone service, houses in Macon had what were known as party lines, where scores of farmhouses might share one telephone line. To distinguish between each, different rings were used. Thus, a ring, ring might signal that someone was calling for you, while a ring, ring meant it was for your neighbor. This was all well and good, except that anyone on the loop could, if they were adept, pick up the phone and listen in to anyone else's conversation. Some women in Macon, it was said, spent a good amount of time doing this. They were the same ones who could be seen huddled together at tables or in the vinyl booths at the local diner the next day. These whispers held an unusual amount of power in a town as small as Macon. Technically, there was an official town government, but the city council met only once a month, for an hour and a half or so, in a small building under the water tower. None of the councilmen were professional politicians, to say the least. The mayor at the time was a good-natured man with white hair named Wayne Jones. His day job was as the janitor at Macon High. More problematic for Sweet, most everyone in town cared what went on at the high school. Because Macon was so small and had an unusual number of large families, the Jessies numbered 15, the Tomlinsons 14, just about every adult in town could claim children, nieces, nephews, or grandchildren who attended Macon High. And thus, most everybody had a stake in what went on there. If the town's power structure was loose, the school's was the opposite. The principal answered to the superintendent, who in turn answered to the school board, which consisted of 7 elected men, and they were always men, who were usually parents or important local citizens. Men like these had usually come of age during World War II, then settled down to raise large, God-fearing families. To them, teachers were expected to instill discipline and emphasize that there was a right way and a wrong way to do things in life. The sooner you learned to do the former, the sooner you'd have your own large, God-fearing family. Sweet, it became apparent to the board and many others in town, wasn't much interested in any of that. What they needed was someone to keep him in line, because Britton didn't seem inclined to do so. When Britton was elevated to superintendent, hope arrived in the form of a new principal by the name of Bill McClard. When he moved to Macon at the age of 32, Bill McClard was, without a doubt, a man on the rise. Armed with a bachelor's from Illinois State and a master's from Eastern Illinois University, he'd worked at 2 high schools, first as a teacher and then as principal. The son of a Navy man, McClard was short and thick, with a boxer's nose and a soft chin. A heavy smoker, he'd developed a bit of a paunch in his 30s and, due to a bad back, tended to hunch forward as he walked, giving the impression that he was carrying a heavy load that he was in a great hurry to deliver. A reserved, proud man, he'd been deeply influenced by his time in the Army. As a result, McClard saw school as an extension of the military, a hierarchical system in which teachers were the lieutenants and students were the foot soldiers. Like many teachers at Macon High, he kept a wooden, cobblestone-sized paddle on his wall. These paddles were treasured items. Some teachers named them. Board of Education was popular, while others whittled holes in the wood, the better to approach maximum smacking velocity before making contact with a young man's backside. When students got into trouble, especially male ones, McClard sent them to the gym. To a call of, "Line up the miscreants," the boys turned and bent over so that a cadre of teachers could take turns doling out blows. Sometimes the teachers wound up and halted just short of making contact, just to see the boys jump. Needless to say, McClard found a welcoming community in Macon. Britton had hired him because he was talented and came highly recommended, but also because he knew the school needed someone to play the role of bad cop. Needless to say, McClard's zealous embrace of this role went over well with the school board. Meanwhile, the other teachers, an inclusive collegial bunch, invited him to play cards, drink beer, and on the weekends, attend raucous pig roasts. His wife, Viola, a pretty and gregarious brunette who went by Vi, quickly became a fixture on the social scene, attending the women's club meetings and, to many, serving as better company than her husband. The couple was happy in Macon, and McClard saw the job as an ideal stepping stone to bigger and better things. An ambitious, intelligent man, he had visions of larger school districts, maybe eventually a job at the State Board of Education in Springfield. He had only one problem. Its name was Lynn Sweet. By the time McClard was established in Macon, Sweet had settled in quite nicely, or so he believed. He'd become friendly with a group of teachers, was beloved at the taverns, and knew the best spots to go fishing and hunting. Still blazingly single, he used his $450 monthly take-home check to rent a tiny month-to-month apartment over the laundromat on Front Street that, while spare, suited him just fine, even if it didn't allow him to be much of a host. when one of his teaching buddies came over one night with dinner. Sweet looked around for plates, only to realize he didn't have any. Instead, they ate right off the table. Sweet had expected some blowback to his unconventional teaching methods. Even so, he found he'd underestimated just how traditional Macon High was. All it took for a reminder was a walk down the hall to the class of Jack Stringer, a bow-tie-wearing ex-Marine who had the bottom of his ear shot off in combat. Early in Stringer's tenure, a tall, petulant student made the mistake of talking out of turn during class. Stringer strode over to the boy, picked him up by the shirt collar, and threw him up against the wall. Then he stared the student in the eye and yelled, "Big boy, if you even think about talking again while I'm talking, I will come right back here, and me and you are going to go round and round." When the boy started talking again minutes later, Stringer threw down his chalk, took four quick steps, and put the student to the ground, using a knee to pin him. "I told you I'd be back, big boy. Remember, I killed men better than you in Korea. Just go ahead, just try it again." And that was all it took. Stringer became so feared at Macon High that one time, when he had to leave school at noon feeling sick, his next class of students arrived and sat in absolute silence for 45 minutes awaiting his return, lest Stringer come back and find them talking. Sweet, however, refused to engage in corporal punishment or intimidation. As he liked to say, if you do it right, you don't need the hammer. If the students had balked at Sweet's methods or overrun his classroom, it would have been easy for McClard to rein him in. But the opposite was the case. The students adored Sweet, whom they saw as young, interesting, and suffused with big city cool. Other teachers expected to be addressed as Mr. or, on the field of play, Coach. Sweet instructed his kids to call him only Sweet. So they did. Carl Pelker, the young, blonde math teacher hired away from Caterpillar, at first wondered if there was a trick to Sweet's methods. Then he watched how Sweet played cards with the kids during lunch and invited them to bring meat to grill on the barbecue he stashed outside his classroom, the smell of burgers and dogs wafting into the nearby parking lot. He noticed how Sweet hung out with students after school, how he took them on hunting trips, and asked about their parents. And then it hit Pelker. He just really cares about the kids as people, so they don't want to let him down. If Sweet bucked the system or didn't adhere to school regulations, Pelker noticed he usually did so on principle. If a rule didn't make sense, Sweet saw no reason to follow it. McClard, however, didn't care how anyone felt about the rules. They existed for a reason, and were to be respected and obeyed on principle. And Sweet not only flouted the school's rules, McClard's rules, but refused to demonstrate the proper respect for a principal's authority. From the start, the two men clashed over small matters: grading policy, how Sweet chose to spend his class time, and of course, the junior class play, which Sweet thought would be more entertaining if he modernized parts, like making the lead male in Just Ducky a recovering alcoholic who suffered from hemorrhoids. It must have been difficult for McClard to ignore other differences between the two men. While McClard was brusque and at times awkward in social situations, Sweet had a way of getting along with most everybody, even those like Burns, the brawny football coach, who were as right-wing as Sweet was left. Likewise, Sweet was a natural in front of the students, hamming it up. McClard, for all his authoritarian bent and considerable administrative talent, had a habit of becoming a nervous wreck during public speeches. His hands shook, his movements became erratic, and he became so anxious that, when possible, he tried to delegate his duties. Linda Schonkweiler, who graduated in 1971, remembers her shock when, upon being elected class president, McClard told her to stand up and give the assembly addresses in his place. Little did McClard know that Schonkweiler's greatest fear was also public speaking. With each passing year, McLard and Sweet's relationship continued to sour. It seemed inevitable that matters would come to a head. It sounded like a grand plan. A dozen teachers and administrators would take off on a Saturday morning in the spring and drive down to St. Louis in the VW bus of Phil Sargent, the athletic director. They'd hit some taverns and then head to a St. Louis Cardinals game. Sweet was charged with organizing an itinerary, and, as usual when it came to such matters, took great delight in doing so, especially since he was a diehard Cubs fan. The Friday before the trip, he passed out a sheet to all involved. Scanning the paper, Superintendent Britton began chuckling. On it, Sweet had included a roster of members of the excursion under three headings. The first read, Cardinals fans and gentlemen of position, and included McLard, identified as principal of Macon High School, Macon, Illinois, Ralph Cote, head of the science department, Macon High School, Macon, Illinois, Britton, and three others. The second heading, however, read, Cubs fans, people of questionable background, including deviants and assorted degenerates. In this group, Sweet included himself, identified as known alcoholic and chaser of females, a teacher named Guy Carlton, wino and part-time street fighter, a teacher named Ralph Lancaster, Pepsi addict and known cigar smoker, and a champagne buddy named Fred Schooley, a friend of Sweet's, suspected sex fiend. Finally, a third header read, Others. This group is made up of people who know nothing about baseball. Here, Sweet included his friend and former baseball coach, Tim Cook, described as a Yankees fan, non-drinker, ex-coach, and suspected psycho, and a teacher named Dale Sloan, who, based on his allegiance, was demeaned as a Giants fan, non-drinker, henpecked dullard. Then there was the itinerary itself. Destination, Macon Motel Dining Room, arrival, 9 a.m., departure, 9:30 a.m., comments, breakfast. Destination, Midway Tap, Stonington, arrival, 9:45 a.m., departure, 10 a.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, Sam and Louis, Stonington, arrival, 10:05 a.m., departure, 10:30 a.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, Zebra Room, Taylorville, arrival, 10:45 a.m., departure, 11 a.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, Morrisonville Tap, Morrisonville, arrival, 11:15 a.m., departure, 11:30 a.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, Harville Tap, Harville, arrival, 11:45 a.m., departure, 12 p.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, The Gardens, Litchfield, arrival, 12:30 p.m., departure, 1:30 p.m., comments, liquid lunch. Destination, Mount Olive Tap, Mount Olive, arrival, 1:45 p.m., departure, 2 p.m., comments, liquid lunch. Destination, Murso's, Edwardsville, arrival, 2:30 p.m., departure, 3:30 p.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, East St. Louis, arrival, 4 p.m., departure, 4:30 p.m., comments, refreshment. Destination, St. Louis, arrival, 4:45 p.m., departure, 6 p.m., comments, free time. Enter beautiful Busch Stadium at 6 p.m., contact the nearest Budweiser vendor. The crew and the game did not disappoint. By the end of the evening, Sweet had purchased 5 Styrofoam Cardinals hats and gleefully smashed them up in front of St. Louis fans. The Cardinals had won, and everyone save Tim, Dale, and Phil Sargent was lit. On the ride home, Britton suggested a game of poker. Cards were produced, hands were dealt. Half an hour into the game, McLard started needling Sweet about his teaching. Sweet laughed it off. 10 minutes later, McLard came at him again. Sweet chuckled once more, but he was becoming annoyed. Sweet liked to think of himself as someone who could get along with most anyone, but he didn't like to be pushed around. Look, I'm going to teach English how I want, Sweet finally said. Your authority means nothing to me. The VW bus went silent. McLeod's face turned pink, then blossomed into an unhealthy red. This was most definitely not how a lieutenant spoke to his commanding officer. I'll fire your ass, McLeod yelled, nearly knocking over his pile of chips. Go ahead and try, Sweet responded.